Hello, and welcome to another edition of Whom Pods Destroy. If you're a first-time listener, then this is a Star Trek discussion podcast that focuses mainly on the original series and is presented by me, Terry DeFellin. Joining me each episode is Derek Mantle and Graham Sibley. In this show, we discuss the third season episode, The Cloud Minders. Like most episodes from this season, it is problematic and flawed, but there is still quite a lot to talk about. Torture, industrial strife, social economic inequality, massive privilege in the face of poverty, even lead poisoning. And let's not forget the very interesting set and costume designs. After the show, you may have some opinions of your own on this episode, and you might want to share them with us. If so, we encourage you to email us at garth@whompodsdestroy.com or get in touch on Twitter at @whompodsdestroy.
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
This troubled planet is a place of the most violent contrasts. Those who receive the rewards are totally separated from those who shoulder the burdens. It is not a wise leadership. Here on Stratus, everything is incomparably beautiful and pleasant. The High Advisor's charming daughter, Droxine, particularly so. The name Droxine seems appropriate for her. I wonder, can she retain such purity and sweetness of mind and be aware of the life of the people on the surface of the planet? There, the harsh life in the mines is instilling the people with a bitter hatred. The young girl who led the attack against us when we beamed down was filled with the violence of desperation. If the lovely Droxine knew of the young miner's misery, I wonder how the knowledge would affect her.
Hello and welcome to Whom Pods Destroy. I'm Terry DeFellin and I'm joined by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And Derek Mantle.
Hello.
How are we doing, chaps? All right?
Yeah, we're all fine, yeah.
Doing great,
actually. Seems like ages since we were last round this table.
It really does, doesn't it?
It really does, doesn't it? It seems like it. Do you not think, Del?
Well, we finished a whole packet of crisps.
Not quite. When you say we, you mean you and Graham.
You must admit, I had more than my fair share of
them. Yeah, indeed. Still, bungee there, 94 calories, so it's all right. You can eat as many as you like.
94 calorie counts, lovely.
Yes, 94 get agains. This episode, we're talking about The Cloud Minders, which is a third season episode in the original series, following on immediately after The Way to Eden, which is what we were talking about in our last episode.
Yeah.
That's rather good. For me, Graham, this is also much like The Way to Eden. This is an episode that is limited in its ambition. Could have been a lot more.
Oh, very much so. Hmm. Very, very, very much so. I think when you first suggested these two episodes, these back-to-back episodes, right at the tail end of the third season, I was thinking about this, and I think that look, having watched them now, it strikes me that The Way to Eden is one that is perhaps unfairly remembered for being worse than it actually is. And Cloud Minders, I think, is unfairly remembered for being better than it actually is.
Yeah. Yeah, what do you think, Dale? I mean, that was my impression. When I watched it again recently, I watched it a couple of times in order to record this podcast, and I have to say that it wasn't as good as I remembered it.
I don't remember it from the first time round at all. I probably didn't see it. You know,
maybe that's a good thing then.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing anyway. So because I came to it fairly with no particular opinion on it at all, and I do concur with Terry that what you said in the last podcast, that in the third series they seem to have some really good ideas, but they don't have any ambition to actually
they don't
make
follow through. They come up with really good ideas and they just don't back them up, or they run out of steam. And I think the thing that also holds this back is it's the main story just isn't supported by anything.
Hmm. So, there's no real B plot going on there, is there? Well, there is the plague, isn't there, which leads everyone.
That's really MacGuffin, isn't it?
But yeah, that's the MacGuffin to just get things kicked off.
Yeah.
There's no. I mean, a lot of these episodes didn't have B plots in truth, but this one really doesn't. One, unless you count the relationship, the sort of romance between Droxine and Spock, but that is not necessarily something that I think is explored that much. Interesting point about that to historians, Star Trek historians, I watched the for a long time. I watched the episode from my VHS collection, mm-hmm. which I recorded from the BBC, and a huge chunk of that episode was removed by the BBC.
Oh, really? I wonder why.
And that would be the when Spock visits Droxine's quarters.
That's actually removed.
That sequence is entirely removed.
Not the scene on the bed with Kirk.
No, well,
that's just a playful romp.
I think actually that really might well be that the reason why that scene is because
it's important.
That romp is also removed because that scene is removed. Oh, yeah. So that that romp is kind of cut and is topped and tailed.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So we have the beginning of the romp and then we have that. So I am assuming that the BBC just probably they didn't have a problem with Spock and Droxine and the actually quite extraordinary sexual tension between those two.
You only take a mate once every 7 years.
The 7-year cycle is biologically inherent in all Vulcans. At that time, the mating drive outweighs all other motivations.
And is there nothing that can disturb that cycle, Mr. Spock?
Extreme feminine beauty is always disturbing, madam.
I think they were more concerned about the bordering on the sexual violence that was happening between Kirk and Vanna, which was a little bit disturbing, I think, and a sort of thing that you probably wouldn't see now.
You sleep lightly, Captain.
Yes, duty is a good teacher. I see you've changed your dressmaker.
Release me!
So you can attack me again? That would be foolish.
Call the guards if you're afraid, Captain.
I'm not afraid. In fact, I find this rather enjoyable.
I do not.
I liked Vanna as a character, actually. Although, I like a lot of female characters, she gets put in difficult situations.
Spunk.
Yeah, I thought that she was a little bit, one of the more memorable ones. I mean, she'd like to have a tumble with Kirk anyway, because at the beginning of the episode, she's fighting. And actually, before the Sentinels intervene, she's besting Kirk, which is quite good. I bet he must have loved that.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what a lifetime working in the mines does for you, isn't it?
Yeah, so I suppose it
gives you a lot of upper body strength.
But she didn't work in the mines for a lifetime.
No, she didn't. Did she?
No, that's true. But I mean, she's probably come from strong genes.
Good
mining stock.
I mean, that's the thing you mentioned, sort of genes. That this is a this episode really is has got a lot of things to do with Darwinism and genetics, and it's got a load of things that are just glossed over, I suppose, not actually explored.
The setup is there's this planet, all the rich people live up in this big floating city, and all the workers live down in the mines, and they work under difficult conditions. And it transpires that the reason that they are hindered, they're considered to be intellectually inferior, and the reason why is because actually they're not. It's because of the gas that emits from the mines has made them so.
Came to this episode, obviously the names of the people. I mean, the Troglodytes. First thing I thought was actually the Time Machine and H.G. Wells the Morlocks and the Eloi.
Mm.
That's a clear reference.
Yeah.
For me. That's straight from H.G. Wells. I mean, they don't eat flesh, but they are to that extent. Yeah,
or Metropolis.
Well,
the other one. The city does look very like that sort of, the German sort of expressionist sort of stuff that we had. That made such an impact on design and all that sort of stuff. And don't forget Fat Flash Gordon, and Voltan. Voltan.
The Hawk people.
The Hawk people.
No, that's what I got out of it, actually. Flash Gordon was something that immediately came to my mind for this episode. And that's why I think it disappoints so much, because I look at it and I think, this is Star Trek. And yet, Flash Gordon has done this better than what you're doing this right now. And you sort of think, well, why aren't you improving on this? Why? And it does seem... Because... There are good characterizations. I don't think Droxine leaves a bit to be desired, but she's not exactly great in this. She just comes across as being a real drippy girl.
Yeah. She represents sort of like, just like the fecklessness of privilege, basically.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, educated to a very high standard, but completely unaware of her circumstances and the people that are...
Well, she doesn't seem to be that educated.
She's supposed to be like an artist.
Yeah, but she comes across as being thick, doesn't she?
A bit dim.
Non-worldly,
naive,
I suppose.
Naive. I think
but dim and naive, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's the whole thing about the sort of the case you had two sort of cultures from the same genetic pool who are separated by wealth and obviously the poorest people down the below doing all the hard work.
Exactly, yeah.
And then the people at the top supposedly have this sort of ideal that they are better for their being artists and poets and philosophers and all this sort of stuff, when they're even more cruel than the people actually on
the metropolitan elite.
Yeah.
The metropolitan elite, yeah.
I speak for my people. They have as much right to the clouds as the stratus dwellers.
The stratos is for advisors and studiers. What would troglodytes do here?
Live in the sunlight and warmth, as everyone should.
The caverns are warm, and your eyes are not accustomed to light. Just as your minds are not accustomed to logic.
And they shouldn't actually be in they shouldn't be in the Federation.
Well, that's interesting, because I mean I think obviously if this would have been written as a TNG episode, then Ardana would have been applying for Federation membership. Yeah. They wouldn't have been an actual Federation member.
We've
had episodes of TNG, none spring to mind, and those are but the episode where I remember at least one episode in which you had a planet that was applying for Federation membership but was similarly divided and flawed and ununified. Yeah. I mean, in third season's TOS, it's fine.
Yeah.
But it's interesting interesting idea about pragmatic foreign policy, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Is that you make allies out of people actually whose values you don't share.
Exactly. Well, this is like a Qatar, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
It's where you've got a rich super elite and everyone else is basically dying in the sun.
Yeah.
But you know, you're welcomed because you're incredibly rich and you've got a very, very valuable resource.
Yes, indeed. The Xenite, of course, which is the stuff that is used as a, what is it,
so
fertilizer.
Of course they'd be members of the Federation in the real world.
Yeah,
because,
exactly.
You know, they've got something people need.
Yeah. And we have these arguments amongst ourselves, don't we, in contemporary life about why are we dealing with these people? And of course we know the reasons why.
Mm.
And the Enterprise and the Federation Starfleet have a similar issue here, don't they? I mean, the Xenite is required to stop a plague, and so they have to go there. But they're not aware of the brutality of the regime, and they don't seem to be aware of the inherent inequality of the regime until they arrive and until they see it for themselves. There's no background to it, so...
Yeah, well, you think that what the hell about this Federation? Does it have embassies anywhere? You know, do you actually have
due diligence?
I mean, the rich stories that come out of Star Trek after episodes like this, you know, as a consequence of episodes like this, you know, paint a picture of a Federation that's far more benevolent than this and more ethical. But at this stage, of course, no, that is not that. And of course, the purpose is to tell a story, so that's what they've done. And nobody realised that people would still be talking about this 50 years later. So they figured, well, what else? Whatever, you know, it works. We have the Federation, you know, and we have these guys as members of the Federation, and that's our nice setup for it. David Gerrold has a writing credit on this. Episode. He is credited as.
Did he leave his credit on there, or did he change?
He did.
Oh. He
was very young. I think he was 23 when he wrote this.
David Gerrold, of course, who wrote The Trouble with Tribbles, and worked closely with Gene Roddenberry. I had a complicated relationship with him in the end, and he was unhappy with the rewrite of this. He said. In the telecast version, the whole problem was caused by Xenite gas in the mines. And if we just get them troglodytes to wear gas masks, they'll be happy little darkies and they'll pick the cotton we need. which really was
quite strong. Yeah,
I mean, that's quite strong, and clearly they're very, very bitter. I mean, I it's interesting because maybe from taking it from a European perspective, where we didn't have the cotton mills, and although we had slavery,
society. Yeah.
We in fact our high empire was built on slavery, but we didn't have that overt images of slavery, yeah, that haven't come through our culture in the way that they have done in US culture.
Yeah.
And I think that it's very interesting that that's how Gerald saw it. I see it more as an industrial matter. So the miners, there's nothing wrong with working the mines. Working the mines is a good thing. There's nothing wrong with having pride in hard work, and because the work is valuable. As long as you're rewarded correctly and treated as equals, and as you have a stake in that, then it's all good. And that was kind of what I got from the conclusion of the episode of the story, when, you know, they got the xenite, and it was demonstrated that the xenite gas was stupefying the workers, and that once they had their filters, they had become emancipated, and that we were about to see this. Whereas David Gerald sees it completely differently. He sees it as actually just further enslavement. Well, what do you think of either of those two?
Definitely the sort of like in American culture at the time, the civil rights movement is still going on with the overhang from the southern states and so on. It's still very, very raw, and it's raw again at the moment. Obviously, he would see this from his point of view, an American point of view, rather than our sort of our point of view in culture. And you did make the point about an empire as well, you know, the British Empire and so on, that we didn't actually see some of the problems that happen abroad. It is where it is at that point. There's a great idea here that obviously David wanted to expand upon, and it would have been more socialist, I suppose, you know. H.G. Wells, it follows that thing down the line.
I think that, you know, this is originally supposed to be a socialist story, a pro-socialist story, and I suspect that, at this point...
Where I think that's the difference between, because when it's in Flash Gordon, it's more pro-democracy, because they're going against the royal family, they're going against the totalitarian regime, whereas this is actually going against a ruling class it's going against what they would call a meritocracy, because we're more clever than you, we get the benefits of society and you don't, even though they don't realise that
A Greek or a Greco-Roman style form of democracy. Sort of,
a classic society.
Very much in that sort of Roman or Greek style, yeah. But I think the thing is, it's another question of a Star Trek episode that is spoon-fed to you with its morality. And yet we go in there and we know, yes, we see the system. Yes, it's bad. There's no nuance here. There's no nuance here. We know the people, and the people who live in Bespin are bad. But we know that we don't know the Troglites are good, because actually every time they're given an opportunity to show they're good, they kidnap Kirk, don't they? So, every opportunity, look, you're this captain.
Yeah, I mean, Vanna is the one, she's the smarter one, because she spent less time down in the mine, so she's sort of like her brain is emancipated, so to speak. But again, all she does is in fairness, this is because she's probably so used to betrayal and lies that she doesn't understand it when somebody, she has no experience when somebody her actually reaches out to her. Like, I'm going to be your friend here, and I'm being sincere.
Well, she makes that point actually about the start, when Kirk goes on about we're here just for the Xenite, and she says,
"You can go back, do whatever you like."
Yeah, but she says, "You know, you're a starship. You're not here to be a delivery.
Starships don't carry cargo.
You're here to put down a population."
Yeah. Basically. Which, I mean, you can completely understand why how she would sing that. That's a completely understandable point of view.
A lot of Vietnam overtones there, isn't there? Yeah,
you know.
But not, and industrial disputes. Yeah. I mean, when the troops turn up in industrial disputes, and the heavies turn up there on the strike break.
Well, they did definitely a lot of times in America. You know, there's famous cases.
Exactly. We didn't mention this in The Way to Eden, but this is a year before the state shooting.
Okay.
When the National Guard turn up at a university and shoot four students.
Right.
For, you know, for and paralyze the fifth one just for turning up and having a protest about the war.
See, all this stuff does resonate. I mean, it's interesting how, I mean, look, the execution is not great and it doesn't hold up all these years later. And bluntly, I don't think it really is entitled to hold up at the time. But there's clearly reference points and nods to current events that are going on. It's reflecting its time, well, even if it's not doing it very well.
It could have been so much better.
Oh, certainly. Certainly could have done it. But I think it realises that it's coming up with quite a socialist message and then it suddenly backs away from it. What also, as well, it's a story that is sympathetic to terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Star Trek is sympathetic to terrorism all the way through to 2001. I mean, DS9, is full of sympathetic terrorism, as is a TNG. So I mean, I don't think it's got a. I mean, looking back, I can see
one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist.
Exactly. And you know, I mean, like the cast of DS9, the characters in DS9, the Bajoran struggle, they use terrorism to get rid of the Cardassians and
the Marquis.
The Marquis.
A just cause.
Exactly. And then 9/11's come along and obviously that's hardened everyone's view on terrorism, and understandably so.
Yeah.
I think it's sympathetic to industrial strife, is another thing that it does, which then I think it rains back on as well. What do you think, what elements of this do you think have put the blocks on this show? The Z-Night, perhaps?
That's an easy way out.
It's an easy way in. I mean, if you're picking out, if you're like drawing from the deck of cards of Star Trek plots, then like going to a planet to pick up X because there's a problem on planet Y is like the card you keep picking out.
And a product that no one's actually probably tested properly to see if it actually abides by any sort of like health and safety.
This is one thing that is quite prescient about the episode, because at the time...
Agent Orange and things like that.
Well, scientists were only just discovering the damaging effects of lead in petrol.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. That was causing what they eventually caused, what found, was a 5-point drop in IQs worldwide. And also when they took lead out, led to a 30% reduction in violent crime.
Right.
Which
did it really?
Yeah.
I didn't
believe it. Check out your Freakonomics, man. That's pretty.
I mean, again, reflective of that. I mean, maybe there were. I mean, for me, I look at the Xena and I just think that it's better from their point of view to pass this off as some kind of outside influence rather than necessarily
the
disgruntlement of the indignancies of the workers being legitimate and being more about the fact that they're all being driven crazy by this stuff. I guess that's probably what David Gerrold saw as well.
Well, that's it. Do you think, David Gerrold, did he actually have an idea for the story that he was actually going have the Xenite in there
the
at all?
The story is focused primarily on a lack of communication between the Skymen and the Manis, as he called them. Kirk's resolution to the problem was to force two sides into negotiation. He opened the channels of communication with a phaser in his hand. You sit here, you sit there, now talk.
Shotgun diplomacy.
And that's all he does.
Yeah.
He doesn't solve the problem himself. He merely provides the tools whereby the combatants can seek their own solutions. A far more moral procedure.
Yeah.
In the end, as the end of it breaks
does orbit, it make good
Kirk,
TV?
Kirk remarks on this as if inaugurating the problem. The answer was not a facile one. The viewer was meant to be as uneasy as Kirk.
Yeah.
But in the telecast version, the whole problem was caused by the Xenite gas. Yeah. He didn't include the Xenite gas in there. So the way he saw it, this was a straightforward situation of privilege against underprivilege, against economic injustice.
Which is a perfectly valid.
It's great.
It's a perfectly valid thing to go with. But where do you find your nuance? Where do you find yourself in a position where you say, well, without this system, everything falls apart? That's always been the defense of privilege.
Yeah.
They they tried to make that in the bit that I saw yesterday when I was actually watching it. There was a thing that's like, all of our art and you know our poetry and everything like this, you can't appreciate it, you can't do it, you know, our society will fall apart if you sort of like, you know, but we need you to do all the manual labor, which is a typical sort of
But it's interesting because it does open up sort of like whole avenues about the nature of societies, mm-hmm. and the fact, as I was saying earlier, that manual labour does need to be done, and you know, the mines do need to be mined. You know, we do need energy.
We do need
these things. But when you call it an underclass, but mm. I mean, this is at the heart of the socialist message. Is that the working class deserves an equal footing with any other class, because their contribution to society is as valuable, if not in some respects more valuable than us. I mean, and this is the fundamental issue at the heart of the industrial working class and the middle and upper classes. But the angle of this episode is not that. This, I think, is more about slavery.
Yeah.
And I think that's where he's gone. I mean, that final line of what Gerald was saying about get them to troglodytes to wear gas masks, then they'll be happy little darkies. I mean, that's clearly, for me, he's referencing, as he sees this as a metaphor for slavery.
It's quite interesting because in the actual episode, you have the Sentinels, who are people who are taken from the troglodytes and actually given the status as being guards and so on.
Yeah.
You know, like security guards, to put down their own people to keep them under control. And also you had, I forgot the name of the main protagonist, the female.
Varna,
because she had spent time, in Stratos as a handmaiden, basically. And she obviously learned...
Yeah, so lending credence to the idea that if you civilise these people...
Yeah, you know, they can do certain tasks, but, but not others. But also you can, you know, the idea about you throw a couple of shekels down, these people will betray their own, or you know, to keep them all in line.
But of course, we discover that the Ardanians are as brutal, capable of equal amounts of brutality. Well, because they use torture.
They use torture, and you had the first person who's actually caught, who's actually up on Stratos, who decides to throw himself off.
He would rather commit suicide than face whatever was whatever. Yeah. So clearly, this is a brutal. You know, brutal regime.
And they start waterboarding with their raids on Varna later on. You know,
I mean, it is prescient to our times.
Mm.
It's a clumsy episode, but it has got something to say, which I think it's an episode that has some value.
Because you said the actor who plays Plassus.
Yeah, interestingly, he used to be a communist, a member of the Communist Party, and he was blacklisted during the McCarthy tribunals. Mm. For refusing to give names of other members of the Communist Party within the film industry,
because I think the way he plays Plassus is really interesting in that torture sequence.
You said you were going to question Varna, not torture her.
She's stubborn, and as you yourself pointed out, Captain, the search for your xenoid consignment must be short.
Surely there are better methods than this.
Physical discomfort is extremely persuasive, Captain.
Yes, but I won't stand by while someone is tortured.
Is it preferable to spare Varna and allow an entire planet to be destroyed?
Violence in reality is quite different from theory, is it not, madam?
But what else can they understand, Mr. Spock?
All the little things you and I understand and expect from life, such as equality, kindness, justice.
Troglites are not like Stratos dwellers, Mr. Spock. They're a conglomerate of inferior species. The abstract concepts of an intellectual society are beyond their comprehension.
Because, you know, it's like, we're civilized here. This is like, you know, what in here is a thing that can, we know how to get information out of these people.
Yeah. Which is sort of justification. It's industrial, isn't it, really?
And then Kurt saying, this is torture. It can't work, you know.
It's a measure of their dehumanizing. Of the troglodytes, isn't
and
it? Really?
Droxine, to her credit, is listening and gets this. And I think that although she does come across as being a bit flaky, she is the one who questions whether or not this is really the right way of doing things. And at the end of the show, she's the one who says that she'll go down to the mines and says that, you know, she'll see it for herself. So, you know, I mean, there's quite a lot of positivity coming through in the messages at the end of the show. It's just it's just a, it's not terribly well there. But I mean, let's just talk about the Jeff Corey is a superb actor. He wasn't, by the time these tribunals came along, he'd left the Communist Party, but he said he wasn't prepared to dob people in, you know, and he didn't work for 12 years. And then he got back in. He actually taught Leonard Nimoy in school, because he was a teacher in that time. One of my favourite flaky science fiction movies from the 1980s is Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, yes. He plays
Zed the Corsair, but he's been in a ton of stuff. The Cloud City.
Yes.
I don't know. Did you watch? You didn't watch the remastered. Obviously, you watched the...
no, but I have seen the what it looks like
it's
now.
It's a model. The original.
It was. It was made out of green foam, stuck on a load of cotton wool, and then suspended from the ceiling.
I got the impression, for some reason, I thought it might have been a matte painting.
So did I. That's what I thought. And then I found out it was a model.
It's a model. Yeah. It's a fascinating construct. It's originally designed based on Matt Jeffries' designs, another Matt Jeffries special. But I got the impression there that it was a matte painting. The design of the interior, I think, is quite imaginative. As well, given just how low a budget it is. I mean, like, they must only have about half a dozen.
Well, I think they did a really great job with the lighting. You did mention the sort of, like, these seasons that it had probably had hardly any money. I really liked the colour lighting that they used in this, and obviously tied in with the costumes.
And worked very well with the artworks that they had out there, yeah.
You know, the artworks.
Well, there were the bits of sculptures on the walls.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't actually taking much notice of that. Maybe it was the costumes.
I don't think you were meant to.
Yeah, but the costumes. I think maybe I was taking too much notice of the costumes.
When they had that little Morte thing that they had stuck in one of the...
That really annoys me.
One of those things there, and it went... And it showed you that there, and I went, what?
Yeah,
it's also part of the actual original design. Yeah.
Oh, that's not supposed to be there.
Yeah. But those knife, morte, whatever those things, they're just so awkward to hold as well. Yeah, you can't
basically
really.
Trowels.
They're trowels. Yeah. If you've got sort of a couple of bricks over there and a bit of mortar, brilliant. You know, but to have a duel with them as well.
Yeah, that's one of the most forgettable scenes. The actual duel, and you that.
But it was a sneaky duel, because the thing is, he was ready to. This is the duel in the caves. Kurt was going to basically face off against.
It was totally sneaky, wasn't it? Yeah. So, well, let's fight with blades. And Kurt's like, throws away his phaser.
And then the blade's got two blades.
That's not how we do it.
I think that was just
the Zenite gas talking,
wasn't it? It probably was.
Yeah, I think the less said about the conclusion and the climax of this, it's really torturous. It just goes on forever.
And Kurt obviously wasn't firing all cylinders anyway.
No.
Luckily, we actually miss out on a whole hour of it, because when he's down there and he says, "How dare you do this?" He's already been down there for an hour, isn't he?
Yeah. I'm not quite certain about. I think this deadline for getting to the planet seems to be moving, you know, as well.
Certainly a movable thing.
We've got 3 hours. Like, really? I'm pretty certain that you'd have used up more than that in that time. But anyway, whatever. Speaking of those blades, mortes as they're called, Vanna uses one to try and kidnap Kirk in his room, in his chambers, and that leads to probably the most problematic scene in there, and that's this sort of like dual, how do we put this?
Bed romp.
Yeah. Well, you've got the romp between Kirk and Vanna, which, and then you interplaying it with the scene with Spock in Druxine's dressing room. Bedroom, where he is basically super hitting on her, isn't he?
Yeah, that's really strange. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right.
Well, but then again, she's the one saying, like, you know, are you sure you can't get out of this 7 year
cycle? She's asking for it. Is that what you're saying? Is it great?
She's trying just as equally to try.
You think they're both into it?
I think she was just.
They are both into it, and she's disappointed when, like, you know, she realizes that.
Well, it looks for all the world like it's actually they're all about to, you know, get crack open the wah wah guitars and we're in for
some montage of shuttlecraft going through wormholes and all this sort of stuff.
We want a picture of Becca going into the thing machine.
I think I get what you're saying with that sequence. It's all a little bit disturbing.
Yeah, but it's real date rape on the.
It just doesn't seem very very good at all. I mean, it leaves a bit of a nasty.
Well, Varner was kicking Kirk's ass. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. On the planet.
Yes, that's true.
And the thing is that while for some reason, when she's wearing this sort of dress, you know, it obviously her defences are down, and he starts to kick her ass, kind of. But you know what I mean. He overpowers her, it's a bit sort of. It's a real sort of. It really is gleeful as well.
I think through modern filter, there's all manner of wrong with this.
Yeah.
But maybe we can sort of say, well, perhaps these things are a bit more naive in terms culturally than maybe things are starting. These kind of things are just not as well understood back then. We know a lot more about abuse in the last 6 months than we've known in the previous 50 years, I suspect, sometimes. And, Maybe there's a bit of that going on there. But,
well, I think it's obviously just to do with they've got this setup that they want to do with the Spock and Droxy and and obviously Kirk and Varner, and the mechanics of it's actually quite good with the lighting and the shots and everything like this. And actually works than actually thinking out why is this happening and the strength of the people in there. Because, as I said, Varna kicked Kirk's ass before. And this time, it was the opposite way around. In a situation where, if anything, Kirk should have actually been a bit...
This is the whole problem with the episode. Is that all the scenes just... It's just a bunch of stuff that happens, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Surrounding this morality tale of privilege. And that's what makes it, for me, a poor episode, is that while there's things going on, none of them really amount to a sufficient B plot. And really, the A plot's pretty ropey anyway.
And you get long, drawn-out scenes in there where it's just going
so
on forever.
Poorly timed.
And because the pacing's off, because there's not enough story.
Well, it looks like you have lots of different people doing different scenes. So that scene with the Spock, Droxy, Kirk and Varna is a lovely, set piece. Whoever sort of put that together is with the lighting and everything like that. But it jars with lots of the other bits and pieces. It, as you said, it's all higgledy-piggledy here all over the place.
This is it.
We also had the inner monologue, didn't we? Which is a weird one. We had that before in... We've not done an episode on it, but in the Paradise Syndrome we have this. Is another third season episode where Kirk doesn't know where he is when he wakes up after having his memories.
Season three then? Where you have all these monologues.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the only one that Spock does, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Well, maybe in Court Martial there's kind of one, in fun thinking about it. But no, but these kind of reflective, almost soliloquies sort of going on are pure Freiberger, and that's one of the things that he's had. Freiberger, we were slagging him off in the last episode, you might remember, listeners, but he's also the guy who ruined Space 1999 in the eyes of
fans. Okay.
Some would argue that show was ruined after episode one, but for those who...
I love Space 1999.
Yes, me too.
Apparently, that's a bit unfair because he actually... It was his... interest in it that actually gave it a second season.
Yeah.
So it would never have had a second season.
We're being massively unfair to Fred Freiberger in Star Trek. I imagine he brought an awful lot, and some very memorable, very good episodes were...
Well, he is defended by quite a lot of people.
He certainly is.
Inside Star Trek, Bob Justman defends him quite well there. And I think William Shatner and Nichelle Nichols both...
Totally.
Stand in his defense
no one is no one is 100% bad at their job.
No.
I mean, he got there for a reason. It's just that he introduced some stuff that you sort of like just grate a bit.
Yeah.
And that Spock monologue in this episode sort of like adds to that in what is, generally a very disappointing
episode. And there does seem to be a thing that sort of breaks through a lot of the, or just frays the edges of Star Trek lore, I think, in what has been set up in the first two series is something they've played fast and loose with in the third series, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's done in a bad way in especially these trailing off episodes. I read somewhere about Fred Freiberger that in an interview he gave in the 80s about how he wouldn't cast black actors as aliens because he thought it would be weird.
Right.
Because he thought, you know, like if you saw a black person there as an alien, you'd think that was, in his words, nutty.
Right.
It doesn't go on to explain it, but why his take. Opinion. But yeah, that was his. And I think if you know, the troglodytes, if they'd been cast a full black cast there, maybe you might have got a bit more of that slavery.
Hmm.
Funny enough, when I was watching the troglodytes, they actually looked like Native American Indians.
Well, that's probably because they were black-faced, and that's another thing that Freiberg liked to use as well. Because remember, Day of the Dove is another one.
Used boot polish there.
Yeah.
And also on Paradise Syndrome, which is another thing.
Paradise, red-faced, isn't it?
Where red-faced, so no Native American actors were using that in that show. I
mean, yeah.
We will never, ever do a Paradise Syndrome episode on this podcast because... we'll just be too negative about it. And
funny enough, I watched it last night.
We can mention it in passing, maybe.
Or maybe
if you want to, we could
have the most problematic episodes and just turn under that.
They'll all be from the third season, maybe. I don't know. Maybe not actually.
Which goes to show. I mean, well, the thing is, like, you've got episodes like that, and you finish it off with Turnabout Intruder.
Yeah,
the most misogynistic episode around.
Yeah,
and one that comes up with concepts that the, you know, the Star Trek have been trying to retcon ever since.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no. Maybe a Paradise Syndrome and Turnabout Intruder double would be the thing to do. That'll bring in the listeners. That'll bring them in.
Maybe one of the several different those episodes, and they'll be.
You, Graham.
Oh, ouch. No, I think we should take a turn. We should pick out the three. We should find another episode.
Oh, another episode.
Pick the three most, and we'll all of us defend it.
Yeah.
And so
it'll be the Crown Court, won't it?
We could break out TOS.
The Court of Pods.
Do Code of Honor, that first season episode of Next Generation that is the most racist thing ever. I don't know if I'm comfortable defending that, though, thinking about it. I reckon we've probably seen this episode off, haven't we? I'm disappointed. I was hoping that we'd celebrate this one a little bit more because I do quite enjoy this episode, but actually on it doesn't bear close inspection at all.
No, but you know, I think the thing is, though, I think as Derek has pointed out, is the fact that we're the sort of people who would like this content and like the ideas that it's looking at, but because it just doesn't investigate them, it doesn't push it, and it doesn't allow for any nuance to come through. It just doesn't work. It just is poor.
And on that, I think we'll finish it up.
Sorry, guys, I'm still in the final lines.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah,
final
brilliant.
Thought is now a regular thing. Thank you for listening for Whom Pods Destroy. We hope you enjoyed our discussion about the Cloudminders. If you have anything to add, or if you feel we've missed something, then by all means, get in touch with us. The best way is probably on Twitter, although we're using Twitter less and less, though, in fairness. We don't really have much in the way of social channels. So maybe send us an email, garth@whompodsdestroy.com. That's our email address. We're not quite sure what we're going to be talking about next time. We've not sorted it out, and I usually get inspiration during that. I think, oh, next week we'll talk about this. But that hasn't happened with this one, so we'll have to have a think. But there will be another episode of Whom Pods Destroy, and it'll probably be in a couple of weeks from when you first listen to this. So until then, from me, Terry DeFallon, and from Graham Sibley, and from Derek Mantle, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.